Welcome to the Nail Your Nutrition Podcast, a podcast focused on training for endurance activity. I'm Sarah, a registered dietitian and toddler mom in the Washington, D.C. area. I write the blog Bucket List Tummy and focus most of my work on running and endurance athletes, as well as merging the principles of sports nutrition with the principles of intuitive eating.
And I'm Marita, a sports dietitian and fellow toddler mom in Pensacola, Florida. I work with endurance athletes at my private practice, Eat to Compete. My goal is to help athletes learn to fuel their training with intuitive eating. We are two sports dietitians and moms here to break down the nutrition science to make training more fun and approachable for you. Whether you're a novice athlete, a weekend warrior, a mom trying to fit in a consistent exercise schedule, or a top finisher at big races, we want to help you understand the importance of fueling well. We're so glad to have you here and would appreciate you spreading the word or sharing this episode or podcast with a friend, family member, training partner, coworker, or anyone you would think would enjoy it. If you have a minute, please leave us a review wherever you subscribe to your podcasts, as that really helps the show. Now let's get to today's episode.
Kylie Van Horn is an endurance sports dietitian. We're so excited to talk to her today. Kylie takes a balanced, sustainable approach to fueling for performance. She is a competitive trail runner herself, and she's on a mission to change the message in the endurance community, separating facts from fads and changing the message that skinnier is better, instead to one that celebrates performance, no matter the body size. Today, Kylie is the founder and owner of her sports nutrition business, Fly Nutrition, which helps runners, triathletes, and skiers to learn not only the why, but the how behind fueling for performance. Beyond her work in endurance sports nutrition, Kylie can be found running peaks near Aspen, Colorado. Today, we talked to Kylie about trail running and how needs may differ, ultra running, how to fuel Nordic skiing, what she wishes more trail runners knew about nutrition, how she encourages runners to stay healthy and injury free, especially while running on trails. I know I've been subject to tripping on routes. How she suggests fueling for ultra events, especially for those with sensitive stomachs, and some other nutrition tips along the way. I think you guys will get so much information and value out of this episode. I know I did. You might want to have a notepad nearby, but let's get started.
Welcome to the podcast, everyone. Today we have trail runner sports dietitian extraordinaire Kylie Van Horn. We're so excited to pick her brain about trail running, ultras, snowshoeing, living in the mountains, which is a dream of mine, just to have seasons again, and just to see her perspective as another dietitian and learn all about how she fuels herself and the athletes she works with. Kylie, tell us a little bit about yourself and your running background.
Hi, thanks for having me. Yeah, I grew up as a runner in South Central Pennsylvania, and I actually ran with Sarah's husband. We went to the same high school.
Yeah, such a small world.
Started running when I was 10 years old, ran with my dad a lot, and then progressed running in high school competitively, and then went on to run at the University of Richmond in Virginia. And then I ran when I got my nutrition degree at Metro State University in Denver. I had a season of track eligibility, and I ran there as well. Moved on to marathon running after that, and then met my husband in 2013, who actually introduced me a bit to trail running, and got into trail running at that point, and pretty much haven't done many road races or, you know, much road training after that. So that's kind of where my running background stems from.
Yeah, Kylie. And I think your background is so unique. First of all, it's so cool that you did another semester in grad school for running. I always had a dream because I played softball in college, but I didn't play all 4 years. And I was always like, well, what if I just took it up again and used another year of eligibility? So how cool is that? Did you find that it was hard to get back to the sport, or?
I was still training with some training groups in Boulder at the time, but I would say yes, it was a kind of a weird transition because I was 26 years old and, you know, training with the team where there's 18-year-olds as well it was just interesting. And I actually think since I graduated, like a year or two after I graduated from Metro State, I think that the Division II eligibility rules change. So I don't even know if you can do that anymore, which makes me feel really old.
Wow. So speaking of college running, what was the running situation like for you as a college runner? Because I know now I'm sure all of us have clients that have come to us. Maybe they were a college athlete, maybe not. But either way, we live in this diet culture where there's a huge pressure to be thin or try to lose weight, eat less. So I'm curious what your experience was like as a college runner.
Yeah. So I talk a little bit about, actually, I'm going to flash back to high school really quickly, because in high school, it was when I first started to pay attention to like body image and the running culture in general and eating and that sort of thing. When I was a junior in high school, I specifically remember going to the regional cross country meet with one of my friends, and we went to get t-shirts before the meet, and they asked us what size we wanted, and we asked for smalls, and the lady at the table was like, "Oh, well, we're saving these for the smaller girls, so you'll have to take mediums."
Oh no.
Yeah. And so I specifically remember that. And honestly, that had a big impact on me moving forward. And I did struggle with comparison of body image and then some control around food. I never had a diagnosed like full-blown eating disorder, but definitely I would say a disordered relationship with food. And then when I went to college, I would say it just blew up even more in regards to how much pressure there was from coaching staff and from other teammates to look a certain way. There was definitely the thinner is faster mentality. I remember, you know, we would be going to the dining hall and we were told not to be eating like the frozen yogurt and desserts. So we had limitations on things that we weren't supposed to eat. And then I also remember like finishing long runs with teammates, and we would go to the dining hall and they would only get a salad. So you'd be doing like a 20 mile run and then just get a salad as your post-run recovery, which isn't going to be great, you know? There was definitely that pressure. We would have weigh-ins as well, which I know I'm sure a lot of collegiate runners and athletes can relate to things like that, which unfortunately are, I think, still part of the culture.
Yeah. So would you say that whole experience, like, did it or does it kind of play into your view that you take with athletes now and working on nutrition?
Yeah, definitely. I try to take a really balanced approach to nutrition. I also, my husband has, he struggled with his own eating disorder. He was a cyclist, and he openly talks about the struggle he had with his eating disorder. And so I think it's really important to, with people that I work with in my own practice, to keep an open mind and to make sure that, you know, I don't take that restrictive approach. And I really try to be empathetic with everyone that I'm working with.
Who do you work with primarily?
So the majority of, I would say half of the people that I work with are triathletes. And then the other half would be ultra runners, some road runners, not as much, trail runners, and Nordic skiers.
Oh, cool. That's exciting.
Yeah.
Because you're based in Colorado still.
Yeah, I'm in Carbondale, which is near Aspen.
Oh, that's so beautiful.
Yeah, it's up in the mountains. I feel pretty lucky to be able to live here and run a private practice, virtual private practice.
That's amazing. Yeah. What would you say are some of the biggest challenges and pitfalls you see among the athletes you work with in that population?
So I think for a lot of us that work with the endurance sports, we can go and work with athletes and talk about all of the latest research and honing in on little nutrition details. But for the majority of people, I find that they need to get back to the basics. So the foundations of fueling is what I like to call it, or the base training. So thinking about eating enough, and I know that is sometimes oversimplified in the media, like eating enough, what does that mean? But a lot of endurance athletes do not eat enough and they don't have awareness around what their needs are. Nutrition composition and nutrition timing, those are the things that are going to make a really big difference in someone's performance. Some of the other smaller things, yes, I'm not going to deny that something might make, you know, a small percentage of a difference, but in regards to overall, like what the biggest challenges are. It's going to be that timing, regular eating, eating enough, composition, those sorts of things. And there are many endurance athletes that think that, oh, I don't need to work on that. And they just dismiss the foundations of fueling and they focus on these little things. They get fixated on them because the endurance population does tend to be very like data driven, very detail oriented.
Yes, absolutely. And it's funny that you say like the foundation stuff. I totally agree. And I think I find that a lot of athletes come to me thinking they know it. Like they know the foundations, that's the simple stuff. But then when we talk about carbohydrates and what they really are and how many foods are a carbohydrate and how much carbohydrate they actually need, they're really surprised to learn how different it is than what they originally thought.
Yeah, for sure. I think so bringing awareness around those things is really important. And then the other thing that I find is that, okay, well, maybe they have read something or they have a lot of nutrition knowledge from the past, but do they know how to apply that to their life? And that's really a big part of what I try to do when I'm working with people is making sure that what we talk about, that people get the education, but then that they also know, okay, for me, how am I going to make this happen in my own life? Because if there's not that connection there, I find that, you know, it doesn't tend to be as effective.
So you spoke earlier too that now you do a lot of running on trails more often than road. So can you tell us a little bit about what makes trail running different than road running?
In regards to the nutrition or?
Yeah, in regards to nutrition needs or just even just logistically, like if someone's used to running on the road and maybe they're planning to go out for a trail run, is there anything different that they should prepare for?
Yeah. One of the reasons why I moved to trail a little bit was the focus in road running on time and the watch and trying to get, you know, be a certain pace. And with trail running, it's quite difficult to compare different terrain and different, you know, different trail races and courses. And so I find that actually to be quite freeing because for so long, especially in high school and college, I was just chasing a clock. And so I think, you know, how does that apply to nutrition? Well, when we're looking at how long someone is going to be out on the trail compared to the road for a run that is a particular distance, it's most likely going to be a lot greater amount of time on the trail. So you need to make sure that you're planning your fueling correctly for that and making sure that you understand the terrain that you're going to go on as well. So that's going to make a difference, you know, a flat trail run versus a hilly mountain run, then they're the same distance doesn't mean that they're going to even take remotely the same amount of time, you know, 10 miles on a flat trail versus a mountain trail. There could be a 2-hour time difference there.
Yeah. And that's just so freeing. And I think that's probably why a lot of roadrunners are, you know, go to trail because you don't have to be a slave to that watch. You just worry about how far you can go and if you can get through that terrain, depending on what it is.
Yeah, it's definitely, I mean, I would say it's very freeing in a sense. Like I was saying, for so long, I was just so focused on getting a certain time to try and get a college scholarship or trying to qualify for the Olympic trials and getting that certain trials time qualifier. And now not having that focus has been really great for just overall enjoyment of being outside and still challenging myself as a person. I think that applies to a lot of people that get into trail running.
Yeah, just getting to the heart of why we run instead of getting caught up in pace and goals and PQs. And like you said, OTQs, like that, none of that really matters. And we forget why we started running in the first place.
Yep, exactly.
And where you are in Colorado, Kylie, we're so jealous of all the trails you have access to. I mean, if anyone follows you on Instagram, I mean, the stories you post of the beautiful scenery around you, I'm just like drooling with jealousy over here.
Yeah, I mean, it is, again, I'm very lucky to live where I live and it's definitely an amazing backyard. And I just feel grateful that I can get out with, oftentimes I go with my two well, my one Australian Shepherd, and then my other Australian Shepherd puppy is going to be part of the pack too. So going out on long adventures is always really fun. And the fact that we don't have to drive very far is also a perk.
Oh, they're so cute. I love seeing your puppy posts. They're so sweet. I bet that's fun to get them some exercise too.
Oh yeah, my older one, she's gone on like 20-mile mountain runs with me, so it's pretty fun to
have a buddy.
Yeah, have a buddy. And then I feel like dogs, especially working dogs, they want to have a job, and so giving her that job that she really enjoys is something that's cool.
Yeah, we had an Alaskan Malamute who unfortunately passed away last year, but she would go with me on many, many, many runs. I mean, she ran 100-mile plus months with me sometimes. So she loved it. Yeah, it's fun to have a little pet with you, a big pet with you.
So Kylie, how do you feel personally? I'm not sure how far or what sort of distance you're racking up these days, but when you were training or doing marathons, or if you're currently doing long distance runs, what's your fueling strategy look like?
Yeah, so, well, for one, currently, unfortunately, I have been struggling with a persistent, I broke my foot running on a trail last year. I like kicked a rock and it broke my metatarsal. And so I'm coming back from that. But in the past, I think it is personal preference as to whether someone wants to use a hydration vest or a waist belt or, you know, a handheld. But I do think that that's a logistic that some runners don't even really consider. Like, how am I going to carry my fuel on longer training runs on trail? So thinking about what mechanism you're going to use to carry hydration, and then also your fuel source. And so for me, I have had a lot of success with Scratch Labs. Now, I'm not saying that that's like the only hydration formula that works, and I think everyone should be trying out different products to see what works for them. But Scratch tends to be, I like fruity flavors, and I think their stuff is like not super overly sweet in my opinion, so I really like that. And I've used it in some of the trail races and some of the longer adventures that I've done. And then the other thing that I really like that I got last year was they have these soft flasks that are have a filter built into them. So they're, the one that I have is the Katadan soft flask, and what it is you can get water from streams. And then you put the cap on and you can actually drink straight from the soft flask, and you don't have to put any like tabs in there to kind of clear the water out. So you just straight drink through the filter, and you can carry it in your vest or pack. So it's pretty, that was a game changer for me, because I felt like I would go out and then I would always have this mindset of being like, do I have enough water? What if I'm out here longer? Like, what am I going to do? And so I would try to ration water and fluids properly, but sometimes I wasn't always the best at estimating how long a run was going to take. So I definitely can't say that I've been always perfect with that judgment. So getting two of those soft flasks with the filter has been like game changing for me. And then in regards to like foods, it kind of depends on what I'm doing. And so I think when we look at nutrition for trail and ultra events in particular, looking at what distance you're going to be running and what that intensity is going to be like is important when you're making choices for what to be eating food-wise. So for instance, if I'm doing a quicker like half marathon on the trail, it's still going to take like, you know, probably over 2 hours, maybe even 3 hours. But, you know, I'd be going at a higher intensity. So I would want to be taking some kind of chews or gels, or, you know, the Spring Energy or Muir Energy food blends are options as well. But I probably wouldn't be taking as much of the food options like the, you know, breads like banana bread or muffins or a PB&J or something like that. That would be saved for a longer effort. And, you know, when you're doing longer efforts, you are going at lower intensity. So typically you can eat a little bit more and your digestive system can handle a little bit more.
So you're saying if you're going longer and slower, you tend to have more real foods with more fats and proteins versus just carbs, which you would focus on out on the road.
Yep. And I wanted to make this point because I knew it was going to come up. So I asked a question the other week about terms in the sports nutrition world that kind of people get bothered by. And one of the terms that someone mentioned to me was real food. And they get like triggered by that because it makes gels, I guess, seem like not a good option. And it like triggers their disordered eating thoughts. So I thought it would be fun to mention that to you guys and everyone that's listening, that some people are like the wording that we use influences people's decisions. And so I'm trying to now say sports nutrition products versus food options. And it's been a really hard switch. I know that sounds silly, but I'm used to saying like real food options versus gels. But now I'm trying to make that switch because someone actually pointed it out to me and I was like, okay, that's a pretty good point. So I don't know what your guys' thoughts are on that, but.
No, I mean, it's true because you think like real food and then should I not have a gel? Should I have a gel? Does that count? I hadn't even thought about that. That's such a good point.
Well, and it's just, there's this, in a way, saying real food versus saying gels, it puts a stigma on gels or chews and things like that, and makes it sound like people that use those things, maybe, you know, those are bad things to be using, I guess, is the point this person was trying to make.
Overprocessed and filled with more sugar. And
exactly. So I think having that conversation is important, actually. The fact that this person brought it up to me, I was like, okay, you know, some people might not think it's that important, but I think especially in the sector that we work in, I know Sarah and Marita, you guys both take like more of a balanced approach, intuitive eating approach. I think that being cognizant of that and aware that that could potentially be triggering to somebody with disordered eating or an eating disorder is, you know, beneficial.
Yeah. And I think it just goes back to knowing that there's a time and place for all foods and that all foods can fit, including sport foods, gels, chews. I mean, it's not like you're going to bring a loaf of bread with you out on the road to have like real food. You know, that's why they have gels and chews, because they're portable and they're smaller and they give you that compact nutrition. And yeah, they are more processed. But I mean, where do you draw the line for that? You kind of have to realize that it's a little bit more practical than carrying a bagel or an apple with you.
To your point, though, Kylie, it is a great discussion to bring up, especially in the realm we work in. And kudos to your client or whoever it was that made that distinction, because as practitioners, we're always trying to meet our clients where they are. And sometimes the wordings that we use can maybe make an assumption that we shouldn't be making.
Yeah. And I'm not saying anyone's wrong, I guess, for using that terminology, because I myself was using that terminology. I was just wanting to bring it up because I thought it would be beneficial to others that are in the sports nutrition world too, that that others that are, you know, following us on Instagram or, you know, that we're working with, that they pay attention to the things that we're saying and the way that we say things. And so we have influence on people.
And I think that's goes both ways, that maybe other people who aren't thinking about this, maybe influencers or quote unquote nutritionists, people who haven't gone through the curriculum we've gone through, have the experience we have maybe inadvertently harmed people by labeling foods as good or bad, or making certain fueling methods seem superior, when in reality, what's going to work for you is going to be different than what's going to work for me, is going to be different than what's going to work for the person down the street. So definitely a great reminder that it's so individualized. So Kylie, when you're going out for a trail run, what do you typically eat for breakfast? And what does that timing look like before you're going to head out for your run?
So, you know, thinking about it as how long am I going to be out on the trail for? So typically, you know, if I am doing a longer mountain run, it could be 3-4 hours. So really trying to hit something pretty significant. So not just like a banana with peanut butter, which might be sufficient for something shorter. But I usually go with either waffles with a peanut butter and maple syrup on the top, or just like a thicker toast, I guess, with peanut butter and banana on the top. And just making sure that I'm not just skimping on the peanut butter, you know, I'm actually using a good amount of those things so that I am fueling up properly. Normally, I do like an hour and a half to 2 hours beforehand. I probably could draw it out a little bit further than that, but I tend to be fine if I do it an hour and a half to 2 hours beforehand.
Are you doing your trail runs early in the morning? So are you waking up, that's your breakfast, and then you're going right out, or is it kind of later in the day?
Oh yeah. So typically I am doing the runs in the morning, and especially in Colorado later in the summer, if you don't get out early, there's a higher risk for lightning and thunderstorms. So trying to get up, oh, I didn't mention, I do have coffee too. Have coffee with one of those two options that I have an hour and a half to 2 hours ahead of time, and then going on the long adventure.
And when you're on the trails, obviously you made that distinction earlier to that it's a great opportunity to kind of not judge by distance, but judge by time. So are you taking your fuel by, you know, like every 30 minutes or by time? How do you kind of keep up with that?
Yeah, and I have struggled with this personally in the past, because again, on the road, I feel like I would always be focused on like, what pace am I running? Or like, how far into the run are we? And so it was almost easier to fuel then because you're thinking about it, that kind of thing more. But on the trail, I have tried like the beeper on the watch thing, which has been helpful. And then, you know, just getting into, I guess, starting there, I have a reminder on my hand sometimes, but getting into that regular fueling habit with reminders first and then transitioning away, I feel like I've been doing trail running for a couple of years now, and I can gauge a bit better as to like where I'm at time-wise and how long I've been out and how regularly I need to be fueling. So I feel like with practice, I've kind of gained the skill, which is what, you know, when we're working with people, that's what we want them to achieve as well.
How often do you have your watch go off? Do you have a certain time based on how far you're going?
Yeah, so I'm usually doing like every 15 minutes. And what I like to do is take in some hydration mix, some water, and then I'll take in some kind of like fuel option. And I might not, you know, I might not take a whole gel at one time. So I might take half a gel, and then in the then at 30 minutes, I might take the other half. And then at 45, I might take in like half a little bit of pumpkin bread or something. And then an hour I'll take in. So maybe smaller hits of nutrition versus larger hits. And for me, that's kind of personal preference, because I find that it goes better for digestion.
That was kind of my strategy, or has been my strategy in the three marathons I've run too, is kind of breaking it up, taking half a gel at a time and stopping for water at every water station. I'm going to ask this because I'm curious. What are the dogs doing? Are they drinking water? Are they taking any food in?
Are we on a dog nutrition podcast now?
I know, right?
I feel like I should know this. I'm
not claiming to know a lot about dog nutrition, but normally I will take extra water in my pack for my dog. And then I will, you know, usually in Colorado, there's some kind of stream or there's snowpack if you get up higher. So my dog loves going in the snow. And so that's where she's getting hydration. Now dogs, the little I know about dog nutrition, they utilize fat stores more for fuel. So really they don't need, like, you don't need to be like giving them gels and treats and things like that, because they work off of their fat stores really well.
That's so interesting. Yeah. With my doggy, we used to have like a little pack, and she would hold her own water. Like, we put water bottles in there and a foldable water bowl. But we also lived in Georgia, so it was really hot.
Oh yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Ornelia Nutrition Self-Paced Fueling Course. Whether you're a new or seasoned athlete, the Nail Your Nutrition course offers all of the information needed to prepare you, fuel you, and help you recover from endurance activity. The Nail Your Nutrition course has modules on macronutrient distribution, hydration and electrolytes, endurance needs for female athletes, vegans and vegetarians, nutrients of concern, supplements, tips for triathletes and endurance, ultra endurance runners, tips for relative energy deficiency, and more.
We also include case studies to tie everything together, as well as videos and downloadable handouts. Plus, you have lifetime access to the course. That's right, you have access forever with updated scientific sports nutrition guidelines, practical tips for how to implement them, and you also have access to a private community where you can collaborate with other course members. To join the course and get started today, head to nailyournutrition.podia.com. That's nailyournutrition.podia.com, or head to the link in the show notes. We hope you enjoy today's episode.
So I don't know if we asked you this, but like, what does your training look like? Are you training for anything right now coming back from your injury? And then how does that play into your nutrition every day and your fueling during those runs?
So right now, again, I've had a rough road coming back. I broke the toe and then I started training again. And I do have a coach. David Roach is my coach, but then he was bringing me back slowly. And then I got IT band syndrome and IT band syndrome. If you're a runner, you know how horrible it is and how difficult the ups and downs are coming back from that. So I'm only doing like probably 20 to 30 miles a week right now. And then I also skate ski as well for some like side training. My goal last year was to do this race around the Matterhorn in Switzerland because my husband was going to do Ultra Trail Mont Blanc, which is like the huge race for ultra and trail runners to be a part of. And so he was going to do that. And I was going to do this race in Switzerland. And then COVID came and all of our travel was canceled. So he is set to do Ultra Trail Mont Blanc again this year. I haven't really signed up for a race yet because I'm just trying to work through my imbalances right now before I kind of sign up for anything. But you know, just in general for the summer, I like to get out with some friends that live locally and do like mountain adventures. So kind of always, I guess, in a way training for to go on those like really fun mountain adventures and challenge myself in that way. And then in regards to the nutrition, I feel like I'm not running long enough right now to probably like require any kind of nutrition since my runs are like 30 to 40 minutes long. But my ski touring, I do ski touring and Nordic skiing. And so on ski tours, I will typically take like the things that I was chatting about earlier, like pumpkin bread or banana bread or something. I like to take like Kind bars and a hydration mix and fluids as well.
And how long might you be out on a ski tour?
Kind of depends, but probably for me, like 3 hours. My husband, maybe like 6 to 8 hours. He does like the ultra trail stuff.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
Now, are you helping him with his fueling plan? What's that dynamic?
He kind of eats whatever he wants to eat. He has an iron stomach, I would say. No, he does. He has, I guess, a lot of gut flexibility in what he can tolerate in regards to sports nutrition products. He really does like Martin. And so he does gravitate towards that a lot. And then Scratch Labs as well for his fluid intake. And then in regards to food, he does a lot of like cookies and breads and things like that. Because when you are ski touring or doing ski mountaineering, you have to worry a little bit about things freezing. And so that's another like logistical thing to take into account, is that a lot of times gels will freeze. And so you can hold them, you know, closer to your body or put them in your sports bra if you're a female. But still, there can be freezing going on depending on how cold it is. So what he and I have found that works the best is doing like baked goods because they aren't quite as hard to eat.
Would a bladder freeze too in your pack?
Yeah.
Think about that.
Oh, typically, man, that's going to freeze. So tips that I give for if I am working with somebody that does like ski mountaineering or even runners that are running really long in the winter and it's freezing cold, you can try to use like a wool sock can help. I know it sounds silly, but like as an insulator, that can help. And then don't laugh too hard here, people, but putting vodka in your bladder can actually help prevent freezing. And I have done that before.
So wait, you're drinking while running. Tell us about this.
So you put not like a ton of vodka. So essentially for like a 2-liter bladder, you would put like half a shot to a shot of vodka in there. And it helps to lower that freezing point. And it actually does work. I wore it and wore the hydration pack in a ski mountaineering race called the Grand Traverse. And it took us 12 hours. It's, you know, a really long 40-mile race. And we did that and our water did not freeze. So
they did not teach us this in chemistry.
I know, right? Now, all these tips. And then the other tip I have is with either a handheld or a Camelback like tube. If you take a drink, if you blow back into the cap or the tube, it actually helps prevent freezing in that cap or tube. So those are a couple of tips.
Yeah, those are really good tips.
Yeah. What are the brands or products you recommend the most for your athletes and maybe those interested in trail running and are nervous about transitioning over from traditional gels and chews to quote unquote real food and or different kind of gels? Like you mentioned Muir, I know that one has like a little bit more protein and fat in it. How are your athletes pretty open to trying different things?
Yeah, I would say the majority of people I work with want to try different things. And I think, again, this goes back to they think gels are really bad. But I think that gels do have their purpose. And again, I would say if you're doing higher intensity efforts, I would be taking in gels. And if you're not doing higher intensity efforts, then doing something like even Spring Energy and Muir Energy, while they are food blends, they're going to have a lower glycemic index. And typically, I still on like a half marathon, trail marathon or half marathon on the road or marathon, still would be, you know, recommending a regular gel or chew versus Spring Energy or Muir Energy, unless someone really can't handle the gels or chews. But most of the people that I'm working with like want to try Spring or Muir. And then also I created like a little cookbook ebook thing that's free on my website that like has 5 different food blends that are nutritionally analyzed that people can make at home and put in a reusable flask. So Goo makes reusable flasks. And so you can make your own at home and try those as well.
That's so smart. And I love those gel flasks. I recommend that to almost all of my clients and they're so handy. It's just, who wants to carry 5 different gels?
Yeah, exactly. No, they are really, really handy.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. So I know you do a lot of like Nordic skiing and we talked a little bit about a fueling for that already, but do you like stop and pull over and fuel? Like, can you fuel while still skiing? I know that sounds kind of like a silly question, but how do you fuel especially since it seems like it's so much longer than runs? How does that work?
Yeah. So with Nordic, the fueling is really, really difficult. And, you know, you have your poles. And so that can be more difficult to get things out. And so typically, a lot of Nordic athletes that I work with might rely on hydration sometimes if they have a hydration pack on or something. So getting calories and nutrition from the hydration source. And then with practice, you can do it without, you know, stopping. I personally just stop because I'm not that hardcore, I guess. and I just stop and take in the nutrition and then keep going. But if they're at a higher level, probably you're going to keep going. So just getting used to that technique.
I'm curious too, how is that different from running in that does it spark your appetite more? So the reason I'm asking is I'm thinking like if I do a really good strength training session, I might feel very hungry after and I'm not sure why. Maybe it's because my body's used to running and when I do a strength training session, it's like all of these muscles working that I'm not using when I'm running or it's just different hormones, endorphins, whatever it is. Does that happen with Nordic skiing or skate skiing? Like, do you feel hungrier or thirstier
afterwards, you're saying?
Yeah, or even during.
I personally don't. I do find that Nordic, and this is because my technique isn't that great either, but I find that Nordic is one of the most aerobically, physically demanding sports out there, in my opinion, and because you're working that full body the whole time. And so I actually find that I'm not that hungry afterwards or during.
Yeah, your hunger is suppressed.
Yeah. So with cycling, I get hungry. So biking, I get hungry, but not really with gate skiing.
Do you do triathlons? I know you work with triathletes and you mentioned biking. Do you do triathlons as well?
No, I don't do triathlons myself because I would be terrible at the swim.
Oh, no, I'm sure you'd be fine.
but I used to work for World Triathlon Corporation. And so I put on, I used to be a volunteer director for the Boulder Ironman races. And then I did some athlete relations work and some coursework for them for a couple of years when I lived in Boulder. And so I got to know the sport and the population really well. And it's definitely, I love the dynamic of triathletes. It's always they're very dialed in with a lot of things. And then there's a lot of things that they're not usually dialed in with.
Yeah, that's a really good accurate description of most triathletes. Yeah. So how do you encourage runners to stay healthy and injury free, especially those you work with?
Yeah, so it kind of goes back to a little bit of what I was talking about at the beginning of the podcast and thinking about what are the overarching bigger nutrition problems that runners and triathletes face that they need to be focusing on. So I don't necessarily think it's important to be taking a calcium supplement if you're not focusing on getting in a balanced diet overall already. And so focusing on things like, are you regularly eating? Are you not skipping meals? Because we know that skipping meals cause bone issues in people. Are you eating enough and making sure that you are eating enough? If someone is trying to lose weight, you probably don't want to be in a 1,000-calorie deficit every day. So making people aware of these bigger like foundational nutrition issues and how they can work on those things before focusing on maybe some of the smaller things that might make a difference. So that's kind of the approach that, again, I talked about at the beginning, but that's the approach that I take. And I can get into all those details, you know, and I'm sure all of us can. But when we're looking at what's most important, those foundational things are important. And then I guess I would also say, what else is going on in that person's life? So stress-wise, sleep-wise, are they taking care of themselves in those respects? Because those things can have a big impact on injury risk as well.
Yeah, and that makes sense. I mean, it's not just one thing. And a lot of people, like, especially athletes, we like to just trigger one thing, like, oh, if I had only had more antioxidants or, you know, whatever. And it's the whole picture. It's not just one thing that can really affect your injury risk.
Yeah, exactly. It's usually a bigger picture issue. So it's usually not just one thing. For some, occasionally it might be one thing, but I think, you know, us in the profession, we probably often see that it's not just one thing.
Yeah, exactly. And that can be hard for athletes to wrap their heads around, for sure. So I've only worked with one ultra athlete, and we had a really hard time figuring out how much fuel to bring. And by we, I mean, he did. I would constantly make suggestions and he'd be like, oh, I didn't fuel for my 17-mile run. And I'm like, ah, we really need to maybe work on that since you're going to do a 50-mile run. So I felt like for me as a dietitian, that was the hardest thing for my athlete to really consider, was how much fuel to bring. And I know it can be cumbersome to bring that much stuff. But what do you suggest for athletes who are looking to do an ultra event? Where can they start fueling and how can they slowly start bringing more things with them?
So I think one thing that is really big in the ultra community right now is fat adaptation and trying to go with less fuel to try and become more fat adapted, which I don't really recommend for people.
Tell us why you don't recommend it.
Yeah, this athlete also was like, I'm going to be fat adapted. And I'm like, no, let me tell you all the evidence on that. So yeah, let's dive into that.
Well, number one, I mean, it is increasing your injury risk if you are chronically fueling in a lower state during longer runs. It's putting more stress on the body and potentially causing muscle breakdown. So injury risk goes up. In addition to that, in my opinion, it's going to affect your ability to perform. So like I was talking earlier, I mean, I guess if you're going at 60% of your VO2 max for the entire thing that you're doing, which most people probably aren't doing that, then it doesn't make sense because you're not able to maximize your performance in the runs that you're doing. So over 70, typically what we know is over 70% of that VO2 max, the body prefers carbohydrates for fuel. So we should be providing it with those carbohydrates. The other thing that I've seen as a trend is, you know, there's been attempts with 100 miler with no calories, which was done last year. And I, you know, those of us involved in the profession, that in my opinion, that is just horrible promotion for people to, you know, get themselves into a serious health risk. So, you know, in regards to experiencing rhabdomyolysis or having some kind of heart condition,
right?
Doing these things. And my question is, what is the point of doing this? Why are we risking our health to do something like that?
Right. If you know that it's not going to be beneficial for your overall training, sure, it might be easier because then you don't have to fuel as much. But if you're injured, you're not going to be training at all. So there's no point in being that. And the research is there. Like, you, sure, some people can become fat adapted. We actually have a whole module on like ultras and triathlons in our course. And I do talk about this. Like, it, if you don't see improvements after about 2 months, that means that your body cannot be fat adapted. It just doesn't biologically work well. And some athletes can get there, and it's really beneficial. And those are probably the biggest proponents of it. But I always am just kind of like, why would you try that? I mean, can you really not just carry an extra peanut butter and jelly sandwich with you? Is it really that difficult? Why would you put yourself at that risk for injuries and other issues down the road?
I think part of it for a lot of people is that they experience GI issues when they're running that long.
Right.
And so they think that if they're eating less food, that they, you know, aren't going to experience the GI issues. And potentially that might be, you know, if you're on the lower end of calorie or carbohydrate intake, maybe that will help with GI issues. I'm not saying that that can't, but what we do know is that oftentimes when GI issues are experienced later on in an ultra event, it's a result of one of three things, or more than one of three things: not enough fluids per hour, not enough electrolytes per hour, and not enough calories or carbohydrates per hour. And if one of those things goes south at some point, it's going to be really, really hard to get yourself out of that. So I work with a lot of people that'll come to me and they're like, oh yeah, like, what do I do if I get nauseous during an ultra, or I feel like I'm going to throw up, or I have stomach cramping? And, you know, my answer is, well, let's try not to get to that point, because if you get to that point, it's going to be very difficult to get out of that.
Yeah. And I would add too, it's also not training with fuel. It's not practicing for on those long runs too. And that maybe suddenly you stop at an aid station and you're like, oh, I'm going to eat all of this, and I haven't trained like that. And that can cause some serious issues down the miles.
Oh yeah, for sure.
I also think we're understating too. I mean, eating like this can definitely bleed over into eating disorder or disordered eating tendencies if you're starting to view carbs as unnecessary or not helpful, and then that bleeds into your everyday life, and maybe there's fear foods or you're just underfueling in general. There could be repercussions with that too.
Yeah, 100%. So Kylie, what do you recommend those with sensitive stomachs and GI issues do for fuel? What's your main like go-to suggestion?
So kind of going back to what I mentioned, we need to make sure that the hydration piece and the electrolyte piece is dialed. So sometimes I think people overlook that and they're like, well, is that really going to have an effect on my system? And yes, it will have an effect on the system. So making sure that that's dialed. And then when we're looking at, you know, the standard recs for like carbs per hour and calories per hour, what I might do is start somebody at the very low end of recommendations and see how they're able to handle that. And then if they can be pushed a little bit, maybe, then we maybe try and push it. But so looking at, I guess, the specifics on, so if it's 40 to 90 grams of carbs per hour, I would start at 40, or like, you know, 170 to 300 calories per hour. for a female runner, ultra runner, maybe I'd start at 170. And then the other thing to consider is like the mixture of sugars that you're consuming. I think that's important. So taking a closer look at, you know, we don't necessarily want to just be consuming all fructose or all glucose. We want to make sure that we're consuming a variety of those transportable sugars so that we can make the most of the transporters.
Yeah, no, I think those are really great tips. And it just can seem, I feel like looking down the barrel of an ultra, fueling just seems so overwhelming. Is there a way that you make it feel less overwhelming for athletes that you wouldn't mind sharing?
Yeah, I mean, I think that going in with confidence that you have worked on your fueling plan is something that I highly recommend that ultra athletes do. You know, I think no matter what you do, going into a 100 miler, you can't really control a lot of factors. So your stomach still might go south, even if you've done every bit of practice that you can do and everything seems to be dialed perfectly. There's just a lot of things that you can't control in an ultra event. So my suggestion is why not go in being as confident as you can with your fueling? So trying to strive for a fueling pattern, trying to get in enough electrolytes and knowing what gels and foods are going to work for you. So ensuring that you're testing all of that beforehand. And then the other thing that can be difficult is that an ultra is so much longer than the training runs that you're actually going to be doing. So I get that question a lot. It's like, well, what am I going to do when I'm doing 100 mile? I'm like, that's the thing is we don't know because you're not going to go out and do a 10-hour training run. So you just have to practice like you would do in a, you know, in the 100 mile or whatever you're doing and have different options for yourself. That's what I usually say is if you build different options for yourself, it can really help with that flexibility if something goes wrong. So say you feel like you can't eat anything. Well, if you've practiced with the hydration mix, then you can get some calories and electrolytes in from the hydration mix at least. Or, you know, if you don't have any more hydration mix or don't feel like taking that in, have an electrolyte option for yourself. So like, do you have a salt tab or something that you've practiced with and can use? Do you have a food blend that you can use? Do you have another food option that you can use? So having a little bit of variety and practicing with that variety, I think is really, really important for ultra endurance events.
Oh, such good tips. And I think that's so true across all sports is practice, practice, practice. That's really all you can do to prepare for the unknowns and control what you can. So this probably depends on different races, but I'm just curious, how do aid stations work? And do they have like a special needs bag, like a triathlon? Like, can you stash like Uncrustables and roasted potatoes and grab that at, you know, mile 35? How does that typically work?
So typically for ultras, the race either says you can have crew or they allow you to have crew or they don't allow you to have crew. And so hopefully they allow you to have crew, because if you have a crew, then the crew actually goes and, you know, you can make up little nutrition bags for yourself. And then the crew can have that for you when you come into the aid station area. And so your crew meets you at different points throughout the course. If you aren't allowed to have crew, typically you can have drop bags. And, you know, with the drop bags, then you would want to make sure that those are all like set up and prepared with the stuff that you want. Of course, there are going to be aid stations as well. And one tip that I do give to people that I'm working with is if there's a way to know what's going to be some of the things that are going to be at the aid station ahead of time, that would be great. Because then maybe you can pick a couple of things that you want to practice with. And then if you need to use the aid station, then you have that option available to you.
That's so interesting.
Yeah, I just crewed my husband for a 60-hour, or we're not 60-hour. I was out there for 60 hours, but his like 45-hour like mountain trail event that he did out here in Colorado called the Nolan's 14 Route. So I was awake for 60 hours crewing him, and it wasn't like an organized race, but it was like a kind of FKT type attempt. So I was in charge of like, make sure you have this right thing at this spot. And yep. he actually created like little bags that had a specific number of calories in them and different foods that he was familiar with. And then he would take the bag with him at each station and put it in his pack. And then depending on like how much he ate, he would know how many calories he was consuming to try and stay on track.
Oh, that's so smart. Did you help him with that?
A little bit, but I helped him like with the calorie counts and stuff. He chose the items that were going to go in there, like Snickers bars, and he did have a lot of Martin and things like that. So just, it was nice though to kind of, because when you start to get into like really long ultra stuff, it can be so easy to lose track of like, how much nutrition have I consumed? Like, what have I even consumed, you know? And so it was a way to like kind of remind him of where he was at.
Yeah, that's another great tip. I feel like I lose my mind towards the end of a marathon. So I can't even imagine ultra endurance sports there, not being able to think clearly.
Thanks for all of the insightful tips and tricks. I'm really excited to get this out into the world and have everybody hear all your trail and ultra tips. Now we just have rapid fire questions. So all you have to do is answer the first thing that comes into your head. How does that sound?
Sounds great.
Okay. All right. The first one, what's your favorite pre-exercise snack or meal?
The waffles with peanut butter and maple syrup.
Nice.
All right. What's your favorite piece of workout attire? And I might know this by watching your stories.
Oh, I've got two for this one. I've got Nike fruit tights that have bananas and berries on them. And then I also have a banana sports bra.
Yes. It's so cute. I love it. I need one.
I have a donut one as well from Boa too. Oh,
yeah, that's it. Awesome. We'll put links to that in the show notes because mm-hmm. I think maybe a lot of followers will want that.
Yeah, exactly. What is a food you absolutely could not live without?
Peanut butter.
That's your Sarah too, right? Yep,
that's same. Yeah. What do you wish more people knew about nutrition?
The importance of eating enough, timing, and composition.
Same. What is your favorite show to binge watch during this ongoing, never-ending COVID quarantine?
We've been watching Friends a lot, actually.
Oh.
Just a throwback, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Again, with the comforting TV, I feel like a lot of people have answered that. Yeah, it's good.
And I'm going to add one last one here. Do you have a favorite running-related book?
I'm trying to, this one's putting me on the spot.
I know.
I mean, I always like the traditional, like, Once a Runner book. That's one of the kind of classics, I would say. Does it have to be running related? Like, no, as far as, can it be sport related?
Yeah. What's your favorite sport related one?
So I really like The Secret Race by Tyler Hamilton.
Oh, I haven't heard of that.
Yeah, it's really, really good. He gives a lot of insight about what went on behind the scenes for the tour.
Oh, cool. Ooh, I'll have to check that out. Kylie, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today and sharing everything you know about trail, ultra, skiing, all that fun stuff. Tell us how people can work and how they can connect with you and find you.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me again. My website is flynutrition.org, and then my Instagram is flynutrition3, and then the Facebook is flynutrition, and those are my ways to get in contact.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Kylie.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Kylie.
That wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for listening. If you like this podcast, please subscribe and leave us a review so others can find it more easily. You can also stay in touch with us by joining our Facebook group, Nutrition for Runners. If you have any requests for future episode topics and more, email us at nailyournutritioncourse1@gmail.com. Happy fueling!